This is Age of Treason Radio.
First thing I remember was asking Papa why. For there were many things I didn't know.
On the White Network. With your host, Tan Stoffel.
Welcome. The title of this installment is Race and Genetics, Part 2. I'm going to continue talking about some of the great thinkers, great white thinkers, who were working in science in general and thought about race and what they had to think about race. And we finished up the last time talking about Charles Darwin and Darwinism. And I don't think I made the point sharply enough, but much of the resistance that Darwin faced to his idea, his ideas were considered heretical. And it's really because they were counter to the dominant Christian creation doctrine. The idea that God had created all of the different life forms as is, and that it hadn't changed since creation. And Darwin really ruffled a lot of feathers by proposing that instead what had happened was that all life on Earth was related, ultimately, far back in time, and had evolved. Like the branches on a tree had branched off from a single common ancestor very long ago. Now, myself, I've never seen a problem with this. It gets into my own personal beliefs and religious thoughts. But basically, the fact that what Darwin could observe about the reality around him and what he theorized had happened in the past and what was best described life as it was on Earth, it doesn't bother me that that contradicts what's written in the Bible. But I do understand that for people who consider the Bible to be infallible and sacred and all the rest and take it literally, that this was a very disturbing idea. And no doubt many people were disturbed in Darwin's day and still are disturbed to this day by the idea that man and ape are related at some point in the past. Ironically, Darwin was inspired by Thomas Malthus, the ideas and thoughts of Thomas Malthus. And Thomas Malthus was a reverend. He was an Anglican preacher. And it was his essay on the principles of population that were published in the early part of the 19th century that spurred Darwin to have these thoughts about natural selection. And though Malthus himself was not really a biologist and didn't think about race, he was thinking about people, about population. And he thought that the danger of population growth is that it would preclude endless progress toward a utopian society. And Wikipedia actually quotes him as writing, "The power of population is indefinitely greater than the power of the earth to produce sustenance for man." And that's it. The point here that I want to make is that this thinking about biology and genetics and evolution is inextricably tied up with man himself, and the thinking from the very beginning had to do with man's own origins. And that's what a lot of the resistance to the ideas also was based on, the resistance to the idea that that man was related, how he was related to other life forms, that in many people's minds, man had a special place that was created in God's image and so forth. and couldn't possibly be related to Negroes or apes or anything else. But there is a certain beauty in the Darwin idea, which isn't unique to Darwin, but has come to be called Darwinism, of the tree of life, of all life being related ultimately. And I actually, that appeals to me more than what's written in a book, written in the Bible anyway. And another thing about demonizing Charles Darwin or blaming him for all of this, as if he, this one man, created this problem. A contemporary of Darwin's was Alfred Russel Wallace. This fellow apparently independently came up with the idea of natural selection, also inspired by Malthus. So, you know, ultimately the intellectual roots of this go back to Malthus. Although he himself didn't come up with the idea of natural selection, he inspired the two men who independently, about the same time, did come up with the theory, the basis of the theory that was eventually called Darwinism. But today people give Wallace just about as much credit. The article about Darwin, I read toward the end of the last installment some bits and pieces from that, and I want to repeat here because there are some points to make about these, a small section here. The questions of what race was, and they write race in quotes as if, sneer quotes, as if race doesn't actually exist. This is Wikipedia, of course, so keep that in mind. The questions of what race was, how many human races there were, and whether they could be quote-unquote mixed were key debates in the national field of anthropology in Darwin's time. Well, truth be told, it's still a debate how many races there are and whether there's, they want to declare the debate over. It's been declared politically incorrect to say anything, but there's just one race, the human race. But this idea of there being disagreement about how many races there were and where to draw the line is really related to what the biologists call the species problem, and that is how to define a species. And a race is really analogous to species. Many men have made that point before, but the species problem is itself just a special case of what's called a classification problem. This is the difficult problem of trying to decide upon, to put things into different classes, to classify one thing from another and to distinguish them. And that's useful in many cases to be able to do that. To give you one example, with email, dividing real email from what they call spam, which is useless. There's a fuzzy boundary between the two that it's sometimes difficult to decide which is which, and ultimately it's up to the recipient to decide what it is, which one it is. But my point here is that the issue of how many races there are and where to draw the line is really just a and examples of the ongoing problem of the species problem, and that this species problem is really just one type of classification problem. And this problem comes up in many other things besides human races. Let me see. I thought I had a section here to read about that. Oh, all right, I covered that. And let's see, it moves on then to talk about, this is a related issue here, about how Darwin opposed the polygenism theory, which postulated that different human races were distinct species, separately created. This is, as I said, the creation dogma or doctrine, which saw us as being different and created that way, which they had called polygenism. And what Darwin was proposing was called, in contrast, monogenism, or monogenism, meaning mono, meaning one, that we're all based on, that we're all life is connected, and in particular that human beings are all the same species. And it goes on to say that Darwin considered that all human beings were the same species, and that races, if they were useful markers at all, were simply subspecies or variants. And this is what I'm getting at here with this species problem of whether you call the concept a species or subspecies, and I'm talking here of the concept of race, is really just a matter of terminology. It glosses over the more important point, which is that race is real, and the concept itself is real and it's valuable. And what you want to call it, you could debate that, but that doesn't invalidate the concept itself. This idea about polygenism and monogenism also has an analogy in Carlton Kuhn and his work. It came up in the context of Carlton Kuhn. I don't think he was the one who, in fact, I'm fairly certain he didn't create the idea of this division, disagreement between the recent African origin of modern humans versus the multi-regional origin of modern humans. As you remember in The Racial Roots of Europeans, Part 1, I talked about Carlton Kuhn and how he was a believer in the multi-regional origin of modern humans, which corresponds to, it's sort of the modern version of the polygenism, but instead of being based on Christian dogma, it's based on the idea, the anthropological evidence, the archaeological evidence, the bones and skulls and so forth, and that they've had found up until that point. Kuhn was writing in 1939, although I think that idea goes back even further. Versus the modern day, the dominant theory today is the recent African origin of modern human beings that we all trace back to a common ancestor 100,000 years or so ago. It turns out that Kuhn, the book that I had cited was called The Races of Europe, was actually really just a rewrite of an earlier book by the same title by a man named William Ripley that was published in 1899. So Kuhn's book came about 40 years later. Ripley, like Kuhn, classified Europeans into three distinct races, and I'll emphasize here the multiple races, that he saw even Europeans being divided into three distinct races. And Ripley called them Teutonic, which were members of the northern race who were long-skulled, or dolichocephalic, tall in stature and possessive of pale hair and eyes and skin. This is the class race that Kuhn called Nordic. The second race was the Mediterranean, members of the southern race who were long-skulled, short, medium in stature, possessed dark hair, eyes, and skin. And the Alpine race, the central race, that were round-skulled, stocky in stature, and possessed of intermediate hair, eye, and skin color. So just to emphasize again, the races of Europe. And this is part of a point that I've made repeatedly in the past, is that you can think of race as, in a coarse sense, of continental grouping, is what they call it today, of Europeans who are white, Africans who we call blacks or Negroes or people of color, Africans really, African Americans, Asians, the yellow peoples, and then it's a debate, it's up in the air whether the indigenous people of the Americas are Mongoloids, the part of the yellow race or not, whether you distinguish or not. Different thinkers think differently about that. But you can also define race in a finer grain, such that even in Europe, amongst all white people, that they see different peoples. And the important thing here, too, about this multiple races of Europe is that the mixture, it's a mixture, really, of these three races in the various parts of Europe, and they come in different concentrations throughout Europe. Of course, with the Mediterranean being mostly in the Mediterranean, the Teutonic, Nordic being mostly in the north. And that this reflects the prehistoric invasions and migrations I've talked about previously, the Aryan invasions and and migrations of people that are really prehistoric. They go back before written history, and that they cross modern day boundaries and even medieval boundaries, even back to ancient Greece and Rome. They predate all of that, and so maybe I'll say more about that another time. So again, this historic disagreement over the number of races, the scale of which the word race applies, either at the fine grain or the coarse grain, all of that just obscures the more important point, which is that race is analogous to species, and they both of these things spring from heredity, from lineage, from organisms that are related to each other, and one group being more related to itself and to the members of its own group than another group that maybe lives on the other side of an ocean or the other side of a river, or even sometimes what biologists are discovering, even to this day, are strange cases where animals that look identical and live amongst each other actually don't interbreed. They are effectively separate species. Now, I'd like to talk here in the second half about some developments, two major developments that sprang from Darwinism in the wake of Darwinism and the people, the men involved with those movements. And the first is Francis Galton, who was a cousin of Charles Darwin. He was an English Victorian polymath, an anthropologist, eugenicist, tropical explorer, geographer, inventor, meteorologist, proto-geneticist, psychometrician, and statistician. He created the statistical concept of correlation. If you've studied math, you know what correlation is, and widely promoted regression toward the mean. He was the first to apply statistical methods to the study of human differences and inheritance of intelligence. It goes on. I've got a section here I'd like to read that reflects Galton's thinking. It says, the publication of his cousin Charles Darwin, The Origin of Species, in 1859 was an event that changed Galton's life. He came to be gripped by the work, especially the first chapter on variation under domestication, concerning the breeding of domestic animals. Galton devoted much of the rest of his life to exploring variation in human populations. See, Galton is one of the men who immediately made the connection to what this meant for human beings. So he explored this, and at which Darwin had only hinted. In so doing, he established a research program which embraced multiple aspects of human variation, from mental characteristics to height, from facial images to fingerprint patterns. This required inventing novel measures of traits, devising large-scale collections of data using those measures, and in the end, the discovery of new statistical techniques for describing and understanding the data. Galton was interested first in the question of whether human ability was hereditary, and proposed to count the number of relatives of various degrees of eminent men. If the qualities were hereditary, he reasoned, there should be more eminent men among the relatives than among the general population. To test this, he invented the methods, of historiometry. Galton obtained extensive data from a broad range of biographical sources, which he tabulated and compared in various ways. This pioneering work was described in detail in his book Hereditary Genius in 1869. Here he showed, among other things, that the numbers of eminent relatives dropped off when going from the first degree to the second degree relatives and from second degree to the third degree. He took this as evidence of the inheritance of abilities. This is a taboo subject today, of course, to say that intelligence is inherited is just verboten. You're not supposed to say that. If you do say that, you can't be elected to public office and all the rest. You will be fired from your job in publishing and banned from the mainstream. But the deeper issue here is it's not just intelligence. It's personality. The various personality traits are also inherited. And Galton, of course, was doing his work at a time before Jewish rule and before Semitic political correctness. So he was able to state what he could observe and what he tested empirically to determine if it really was true. Galton recognized the limitations of his methods, and he believed that the question could be better studied by comparison of twins. So he laid the groundwork for these twin studies that have been done since. The best form of civilization in respect to the improvement of the race would be one, this is Galton writing now in one of his books, would be one in which society was not costly, where incomes were chiefly derived from professional sources and not much through inheritance, meaning financial inheritance, where every lad had a chance of showing his abilities. Here, I think, is liberalism, early liberalism coming through, where here he was facing the physical reality of biological inheritance. And yet he had these liberal thoughts about economic inheritance being a bad thing and people needing to be leveled in that respect. Galton went on to he invented the term eugenics, and he's considered the father of eugenics. I'll talk more about that in a second. He also devised a technique called composite photography, produced by superimposing multiple photographic portraits of individuals representing a quote-unquote natural kind, like Jewish men, criminals, patients with tuberculosis, etc., onto the same photographic plate, thereby yielding a blended whole or a composite. You may have seen some of these modern day. There's one particular racialist who does this for various countries. He collects images of those people, and then he overlays them Galton style to create a sort of ghostly-looking average face for that particular country. I think it probably works even better for things like Jewish men. It may not work so well for criminals or patients with tuberculosis, and that's probably why Wikipedia emphasizes that, adding those two other sort of nonsensical categories. But see, Galton was fairly open-minded. He didn't put presuppositions on his experiment. He just tried a variety of things. But this idea, of course, that you could, that there's a typical look to Jewish men is just really one form of Judar, really. I mean, Jews are able to recognize each other when they see certain aspects of certain physical characteristics. The eugenics, let me talk a little bit about eugenics. Eugenics is the use of practices aimed at improving the genetic composition of a population, usually the human population. It is a social philosophy which advocates for the improvement of human hereditary traits through the promotion of higher reproduction of more desired people and traits, and the reduction of reproduction of the less desired people and traits. And actually, that's mixing two things there. One is, the former is called positive eugenics, you know, promoting desirable things. And the other is called negative eugenics, which is, discouraging reproduction of less desirable people and traits. And this, again, this is considered taboo today, that eugenics is bad, evil stuff, and you're not supposed to think about making people better. As a social movement, eugenics reached its greatest popularity in the early decades of the 20th century. At this point in time, eugenics was practiced around the world. Now listen to this. This is very interesting, very important. Eugenics was practiced around the world and was promoted by governments and influential individuals and institutions. Many countries enacted various eugenics policies and programs. They go on to say, the scientific reputation of eugenics started to decline in the 1930s, a time when Ernst Rudin used eugenics as a justification for the racial policies of Nazi Germany. That's a whole subject there, racial hygiene and the policies of National Socialist Germany that, frankly, I don't know very much about. But I will point out here that it wasn't the scientific reputation of eugenics, I think, that went into decline. It was the intrusion of social and moral and political concerns, mostly of Jews, that overrode the science of eugenics and made it politically incorrect and taboo to even discuss eugenics. And that this was aided by massive propaganda demonizing Nazi Germany. The eugenics is still practiced today. It's practiced on livestock. We have improved stock of chickens that laid more eggs than previous generations, and cows that produce more milk. And it's by the same principles of selecting or breeding the animals that have the traits that are desirable and that you want to see more of. This is what even in Darwin's time, he realized could be done, and gave him the idea. Was one of the elements of the idea of natural selection. Another movement that came out of Darwin's thinking was what's called social Darwinism. And this is attributed mainly to a man named Herbert Spencer, but he never used the expression social Darwinism, as I understand it. Herbert Spencer was born in 1820 and died in 1903. He was an English philosopher, biologist, sociologist, and a prominent classical liberal political theorist. He developed an all-embracing conception of evolution as the progressive development of the physical world, biological organisms, the human mind, and human culture and society. So he sort of went the opposite direction of Galton. Galton took Darwin's theory and sort of focused on what it meant for human beings, and Spencer instead broadened the theory and made an all-embracing conception of evolution, but also as to how it would impact the human mind and human culture and societies. He's been called the single most famous European intellectual in the closing decades of the 19th century, but then famously he was pretty much forgotten in the 20th century. The places I've seen mention that don't really mention why that is. But he's best known for coining the concept or the term survival of the fittest. It wasn't Darwin that created that that phrase. It was Herbert Spencer. The term strongly suggests natural selection, yet as Spencer extended evolution into realms of sociology and ethics, he also made use of Lamarckism. That doesn't make much sense, that sentence, but I had mentioned Lamarckism also in part one of this series here. Spencer's reputation as a social Darwinist can be largely traced to Richard Hofstadter's book Social Darwinism in American Thought, 1860 through 1915. This was a book published in 1944. It was a hostile critique of Spencer's work. And I've talked about Richard Hofstadter before. He came up in the installment I called Stupid, Crazy, Evil, and had to do with pathologizing and demonizing white people for having any thoughts about race. And this is the start of it, retrospectively going back and blaming Herbert Spencer for being a bad guy, for recognizing the applicability of Darwin's theories. So I'm done for this week, and I'll have more on this next week. We'll talk about some more Jews and what they had to say about race.